Good evening, everybody. James McKenna here with my Science Hour. This is for June 13th, 2024. Tonight's main science topic, at request of actually quite a few listeners over the last number of weeks, have written in asking for this topic on Saturn's rings. And it turns out that there are star systems that have very similar systems where there's rings. Jupiter has rings. Uranus and Neptune have rings. Saturn, of course, has the big ring system, the one that's very visible. Other stars have rings, and you know. So anyway, what's really going on here? What's the cause of these? What are Saturn's rings made of, and how do they work? Turns out that one of my first peer-reviewed publications in Astrophysics Space Science Journals is called Saturn Sweeper Moons Predicted. It happened to be when I was in the math department at Cornell University and made some startling discoveries. And I was studying, I was just, you know, as part of my studies going on about all of the planets, etc., discovered that there were some anomalies, some visible anomalies in the rings of Saturn, the way they faded. And there was one of the rings that had a very strange fading of the rings on the inner edge of the ring, whereas the outside edge of the ring was sharply defined. And of course, armed with my celestial mechanics work, where I included electric and magnetic fields, I said, aha, this is the telltale sign of a plasma discharge object, which would be small moons. But the problem was you couldn't see the moons from planet Earth with the telescopes that were available at the time. So that gave me an upper limit of about 100-mile diameter of these moons. But that also gave an upper limit of their mass. So they couldn't be very massive. So this was not a gravitational effect. It was an electrical effect. Okay, so I'll be talking about that. Also, some other topics here. First of all, I've just seen so many of these recently about people asking what happened at Tunguska. And in the mid-1990s, I happened to work with a group of Russian atmospheric scientists who had been at Tunguska, and they were very interested in my work because it actually explained what happened at Tunguska. And I don't get involved in these internet there's sometimes like just shorts, like a YouTube short video or something like that, and people are saying what happened. I tend not to get involved in these because there's just a sea of misinformation, and a lot of times it would be, you know, biting a hook, so to speak, and I just don't go there. I just don't become involved in those kind of like fly-by-night. They're not even scientific. I don't know what to call them. They're just YouTubers. What people trying to get minutes or clicks or whatever so they can somehow get paid a little bit of money. But the Tunguska event, here's basically what happened. It was it April 1905, something like that. I don't remember the exact date, but the exact date is not really relevant when something from outer space is happening. Clearly, this was something due to something in outer space related. Let's just put it that way. And the when it happened, of course, the word spread. It was in the middle of nowhere. I mean, it was 100 miles to the nearest town. And the trees were flattened in a circular pattern. So radially outwards, the trees were just blown down and burnt to a crisp. And so they're still there to this day, a lot of them, in that cold climate where they last, you know, for a very long time. If something came in and hit, that would be your first thing, is there was some kind of explosion, that there was some kind of a meteorite that came in, or meteor or asteroid, or maybe some kind of comet. People think comets are dirty snowballs. They're not. They are solid rocks. But anyway, if something physical came into the atmosphere, even if it disintegrated, this is what the current genre claim is that they somehow this object disintegrated to the point where there's nothing left. Well, boys and girls, if it disintegrated and it's coming in at a high velocity, all of that stuff, even if it were at the molecular level, would be all over the ground, and you would be able to measure it, just like you can find iridium layers that came in from outer space. Clearly something happened coming in from outer space, because iridium is not a natural element that just occurs in thin layers on planet Earth. It is found maybe in deposits, etc. But anyway, you would find a layer of something. You would be able to go around on the ground, pick up samples and say, aha, there's iron here, there's nickel here, there's carbon-based, there could be hydrocarbons or other types of chemicals that would be embedded in the ground, or little chunks of rock of some kind, and you say, okay, those are the pieces, but there's nothing there. There's nothing. So that eliminates anything physical. And as I say, the Russian scientists, they were atmospheric scientists from the University of Novosibirsk, and they were very interested in my work. And so we were having daily sessions after their classes in the afternoon. We would set up a session and go through page by page what is known as the three-part comet paper. So they had to have translators, and then they would ask questions going back and forth. And it got to be known in the university. And so eventually even professors from the psychology department started sitting in out of interest. Okay, so, and by the way, during this time is when Comet Schumacher-Levy 9 came into the atmosphere and of Jupiter. And they were recording, the Russians were very interested in this. It had been predicted that these 21 pieces of a Comet Schumacher-Levy 9 would hit the atmosphere of Jupiter. And NASA said, oh, these are little ice balls. You won't be able to see anything. So NASA didn't point any equipment, or maybe they did in secret, but publicly they said, nah, there's nothing to look at here. Move along. The Russians had everything they had, every X-ray detector, every telescope, everything they had was pointed at this event. And as these 21 pieces came into the region around Jupiter, they changed from water comets into sulfur dioxide comets. In other words, the material in their tail changed. Just boom. And one by one, as these pieces came in, there's a picture on the cover of my book, Comets, which is the picture of these 21 pieces all strung out like a string of beads. Red, orange color, that's the sulfur dioxide color. That's why Jupiter has its color, the red planet. It looks very reddish because of the large amount of sulfur dioxide. Around Earth, we have water in space around us, hydrogen and oxygen. Out farther where Jupiter exists, you have sulfur dioxide. Out where you and out by Saturn, you have mainly hydrogen and the lower compounds. You get out to Uranus, Neptune, you start getting the nitrogen, hydrogen compounds toward the point where Pluto is a ball of ammonia, frozen ammonia in nitrogen, hydrogen compounds. Anyway, getting back through the Tunguska event, the scientists had been at Tunguska. And the reason they were interested in my work, one of the many reasons, because what we were really studying was atmospheric electricity and what caused it, because they were making all these observations and they had no idea where this electricity was coming from. And it was, of course, the same thing with Tesla. Tesla had made major discoveries, his Colorado Springs research facility, his Wardenclyffe facility, all looking at garnering energy from the atmosphere. But Tesla did not know where this came from. He knew there was a vertical electric field. You could measure it. It's very big. And but it's the main cause of lightning. Where's lightning coming from? Well, it's not building up inside the cloud. The standard explanation that there's tumultuous updrafts in a cloud and that creates a battery and then the lightning comes shooting out is absurd. Absurd. Batteries discharge internally. They don't have lightning shooting out the top and the bottom. So anyway, back to the Tunguska event, and the Russian scientists, they also had observed tornadoes, yeah, like you see on Earth, but tornadoes racing across the surface of the sun. They're going, what's going on here? What's this coming from? Well, my work explained all of this. The discharge and the fact that then you translate back to Earth, tornadoes and hurricanes and cyclonic storms in our atmosphere are driven by electrical currents, the vertical electric field discharging. So anyway, but is that what caused the event at Tunguska? Because that would be this immense lightning bolt. But even there, where you have lightning bolts hitting, you have things like the Eye of the Sahara, which are physical anomalies on Earth, or ring patterns. You see these on moons of Jupiter, on Callisto. You see many of these. You see them on Mercury, the planet Mercury that has no atmosphere. You see the where the something came by and caused an electrical discharge, and you see the ring patterns. I talk about this in my papers. So anyway, the Tunguska event, I mean, what really happened there? We get a clue also from the Venus event, where Moses was leading the Israelites out of Egypt in this pillar of fire that stood there for days, going up into the heavens. That was the electrical discharge between them, between the comet and planet Earth. And there are places where the earthquakes and the damage are very visible from this type of event. But anyway, so what happened at Tunguska? Well, let's talk about the entire history of the Tunguska event. The local people in that part of Russia, and like I say, when I say local, I mean within 200, 300 miles of the Tunguska event, the epicenter. They said that nights before the event, the sky was brightened. Well, gee, what could that be? Could that be auroras? It could be auroras, but also they were familiar. These are people that lived up there, familiar with auroras on a nightly basis. So they did not mistake this brightening of the atmosphere, what they called the atmosphere. It was really a comet tail. The comet was so close to Earth, probably coming at us from the sun in direction, so that you would not see it during the day. You would just see the night sky brightening because we were in a comet tail. And then after the event, the brightness in the sky faded away. So that it's very clear that a comet was passing near Earth. So it was the discharge from that comet down to Earth. And there are a number of other places where minor, not as big, electrical discharges occurred. So that is the cause of the Tunguska event, and the Russians understood that. So that was the end of the story. So why is the, these, and they looked almost like they're planted because they have really, really good visuals, artwork. That's what set these apart from little Johnny in his basement, in grandma's basement, putting together YouTube videos, is these have tremendous artwork that tells you that somebody is promoting something, because people listen to things when they have excellent artwork. It's just, people can tell cheap homemade stuff versus very well-made artwork, and so that sells. That keeps people there focused on this little video. And of course, they keep asking, well, what happened at Tunguska? It's a mystery. It's a mystery. Well, it's not a mystery. It's been solved. It was solved in the 1990s when I worked with Russian scientists. We knew exactly what happened. It was an electrical discharge. And what also happens is that you probably had a fusion explosion where water in the atmosphere converted to hydrogen and literally the electrical discharge set off a fusion explosion. So it was this tremendously hot explosion. There's no trace in terms of radioactivity from a fusion explosion. It's not like, say, a fission explosion with uranium or plutonium, where these would have radioactive material. No, the hydrogen explosion is in turn very clean. And so there really would not be a residue, just the heat, the tremendous amount of heat. So it was not just the explosion itself, but the fact, and this is part of my work also, is the fact that Jupiter and Saturn have ongoing fusion in their atmospheres. And that led me also to the conclusion that the fusion of the sun is in its atmosphere, not at its core. Now, another question here from a physics point of view is, at what altitude did this happen? Now, let's take another look at this concept that it was an airburst from an incoming asteroid, which there's nothing remnant about that, because the momentum of, if this asteroid exploded in midair, the majority of material would come straight down. It would continue on the same path. And then the other material would go, excuse me, in all directions. So, but the majority of the material would come straight down, and there would be ample evidence on the ground at point zero. The other thing is that this, whatever it was, happened relatively close to the ground, because the trees are blown downwards, they're blown down and outwards from the very epicenter. It's like something very close to the ground is what exploded. And that tells you something. But the other thing, there's some other factors here. The night sky was clear because the residents, who were hundreds of miles away, said when they went out to interview these people, they said that because it blew the windows out of their house hundreds of miles away, and it was a tremendous shock wave. So like an explosion, like a nuclear bomb. If you saw the movie Oppenheimer, there was the example when they set off the nuclear bomb out in the desert, and they're all sitting there with their little glasses on, etc. That was very close to the ground, and this tremendous rush of gases came outwards, and they saw the bright flash, and then later, you know, some time later, the rush of gases came out from the explosion, from the physical explosion. And so if it were high up in the air, the Trinity Tower that they used in the Manhattan Project was, what, 100 feet off the ground or something, not very high. Relatively close to the ground. They had constructed it there. And so it was probably the Tunguska explosion was probably close to the ground. Because if it were much higher, then the explosion would have acted differently on those trees very close to the epicenter. Very close. There would have been let's just say tornadic kind of winds where they would have swirled around or something, and that's not what you see. From the very center, the trees are just flat and radially outwards. So whatever the explosion was, it was very close to the ground. And which there again does not purport to an asteroid or a comet or something like that, because and when I say comet, what they're talking about in these explanations from standard science or from other people that really don't know what they're talking about is they're talking about an ice ball comet and somehow exploding. But still, in there, there's a lot of material. There's a lot of, in their theory, there would be a lot of material that would come down and just label ground zero with material, carbon-based material, metals, other things that would be very obvious. It would be peppered into the upper side of these trees and it's not there. There's simply nothing there. So it was an explosion with nothing there. Okay. Anyway, the other thing was that the people that were there that were interviewed hundreds of miles away, had their windows blown out, said that the nights were very clear. And so you can imagine being up north when it's dry and clear. It's very clear. It's like being on the desert. The air, there's no moisture in the air at all. And so that makes it a rather strange situation because with very dry air, then is there enough water to vaporize and then through electrolysis emit enough hydrogen so you could have a nuclear explosion, a fusion explosion? It's hard to say. Remember, in also this comes from the Manhattan Project, is there was the belief that the atmosphere could catch on fire, where they would, you know, set off a nuclear bomb in the atmosphere and it would simply start a chain reaction that would burn up the entire Earth's atmosphere. That was a possibility. Was Enrico Fermi, one of the great physicists of the time, said that, and it was kind of a quip, but not, they didn't know. I mean, it was, people were throwing out ideas on the table. That if you ever get this bomb thing to work and you set it off in the atmosphere, you could ignite the whole atmosphere, and which you could. I mean, potentially, if you did it in a cloud, say the cloud the water molecules would come apart, you'd have hydrogen, and then you'd have potential for a hydrogen explosion, and that would just cascade throughout the atmosphere. And have, the entire Earth's atmosphere explode. You know, you don't know. I mean, and that's still a possibility. And that's what I'm saying, is that there could have been a fusion reaction, a hydrogen reaction with the electrical discharge that came from the passing comet. But back to the story of the people who lived there, they said on the nights prior to and after the explosion, the atmosphere, they called it the atmosphere, but the sky, the night sky, was bright, and it got brighter and brighter. And then after the event, the brightness slowly faded away. And as I said earlier, these people lived up there. They're very familiar with Aurora Borealis. They see it all the time. So they did not confuse the brightening of the sky on these nights before the Tunguska event with Aurora Borealis. Okay, very interesting. So what really happened there? The brightening of the sky was due to Earth passing through the tail of a comet. So that would have been a slight brightening of the sky. And then as the comet nucleus came by, it discharged and happened to hit this location in Tunguska. And as I said, there were other places where there were minor events very similar to this. The big explosion at Tunguska was not the only one. So that indicates also that the comet was passing by and made another couple minor discharges. And you see this on other, like the moon Callisto of Jupiter, you see this big major discharge where when the comet came close enough, boom, it picked out a spot, the closest spot, and that's where it unloaded. And so you get a single, and it might be the eye of the Sahara. I'm very convinced that the eye of the Sahara, look that up if you don't know what it is. It's this amazing circular structure in northwestern Africa, out in the middle of the Sahara Desert, where the ground is just, the sand is like has turned to glass. And some people think, oh, that was Atlantis. But it does not fit all of the hallmarks of Atlantis. Atlantis sunk under the ocean, and there's no indication that there were any structures of any kind at the eye of the Sahara. But anyway, I mean, you never know. I mean, that might be right. I'm not saying 100% no, but it just, there are other factors that don't fit the narrative. Okay, so I've chatted a little bit longer on that than I wanted to. But that's been in the, somebody's pushing that narrative, what happened at Tunguska, and so I just wanted to include that. I want to talk about Saturn's rings here, but first a couple other announcements. that the Chinese Chang E B, no, I'm sorry, 6, Chang E 6 spacecraft is bringing surface rocks back to Earth. And all the scientists are very excited about this. But once again, surface rocks from the moon have nothing to do with the moon. This is stuff that fell on the moon from someplace else, from outer space. Just like every day there's a rain of meteoric material that comes into planet Earth. Moon is our nearest neighbor. It's happening there. So over millions of years, the buildup on the surface, that is not, it doesn't have anything to do with the moon. So why would you study moon rocks that are on the surface of the moon and try and tell something about the moon? It has nothing to do with the moon. And I just, I don't know. When I see science going on, and this is the same, this goes back to the 1960s. The Russians went up and got rocks from the moon with artificial, you know, with landers that were unmanned, brought rocks back. So they had moon rocks long before the Apollo program ever existed, really. And then, of course, NASA claimed that it brought moon rocks back, and that was one of its proofs that the man went to the moon. But the Russians already had rocks from the moon, and they didn't. They did not land men on the moon to get them. And here we have China doing the same thing, and nobody seems to notice the contradiction that getting moon rocks is not something that requires people standing there picking them up and putting them in a bag. Okay, so at any rate, Chinese are bringing back these moon rocks, and there's going to be a lot of fanfare about that, moon rocks, and they're probably even selling them. There's people that's paid big-time money for moon rocks, remember? So anyway, if you bought a moon rock, I got a bridge to sell you. It's called the Brooklyn Bridge in New York. Remember the old story about when the immigrants would come in, they'd get off the boat, and some guy would come up to them, and they'd recognize that they just came off the boat, and they'd say, hey, you see that? This is America. You're going to be a millionaire here. See that bridge up there? I'll sell it to you, and every car that passes by, you get to charge him. And the story was, of course, the Brooklyn Bridge. I'll sell you the Brooklyn Bridge. And immigrant coming from Ireland or, you know, Europe or Poland or wherever would hand over all the money they had to this guy, thinking that they bought the bridge, only to find out the next day they really didn't. So anyway, there's the story with the moon rocks. If you want to buy moon rocks, I'll sell you some. let's see, how about $100,000 per rock? There you go. Just call me up and I'll sell you some. And talk about selling moon rocks or selling the Brooklyn Bridge. That'd be the new one. I'll sell you some moon rocks. If you believe that, I got some moon rocks to sell you. Anyway, the October 18th, supposedly, there's a private enterprise lawsuit against the Pentagon where they're claiming that on October 18th, they're going to finally get the release of alien UFO information from the Pentagon, all of the stuff the military's been hiding for all these decades. And once again, it's just pure BS. This is the biggest dog and pony show ever. You know, I remember 20, 25 years, 35 years ago, oh, the Pentagon is finally going to release all the UFO data and, you know, Area 51. And no. This is, they had this, I knew when it got onto 60 Minutes, when 60 Minutes gets into something like this, it's total disinformation. So they have these jet pilots on and they go, oh, gee, I saw something confirmed that it was unidentified. You know, and there's a little couple pixels on the guy's camera, and it moved around a little bit funny, and he didn't understand what it was. So that was, they blew that up, and they got more mileage out of that than the Mars landers, the Mars rovers. You know, the stuff that comes out is just so poorly done. So, that, you know, come on, if you're going to fake news, at least do a good job of it, please. Don't insult our intelligence anymore. You've got millions and millions of dollars to create fake news and you can't do a good job of it? At least make it entertaining, please. Anyway, talking of, here's another story. The James Webb Telescope has discovered metals. Now, the James Webb Telescope, of course, is the big brother to the Hubble Space Telescope, and they're looking at, you know, things now that have never been seen by any telescope in history. And it's also able to look in the infrared, something that the Hubble was really not very good at. So they're finding metals and carbon and carbon-based materials allegedly 350 million years after the alleged Big Bang. Now, they found entire galaxies, completely formed, normal galaxies, and they go by the redshift. Well, clearly the redshift has nothing to do with the distance. So, you know, but these fly, and these discoveries fly in the face of reality, of the supposed Big Bang reality, which is a non-reality. It never was true. Big Bang should never have gotten any traction at all. But once these things get into the peer-reviewed journals, once they get a feet of their own, legs of their own, where they can walk around, once the money grant process gets going in the publications and peer-reviewed journals, once it gets going, you can't stop it. Because now there's clear evidence from a major telescope that flies directly in the face of the Big Bang, because here's the situation. Supposedly the Big Bang happened, and for a long period thereafter there was just hydrogen, and so then it had to accumulate, and then the fusion process started where they eventually built up the heavy elements. That's the story. That's the accepted theoretical story. But all of a sudden they start seeing things that are, you know, 350 million years after the alleged Big Bang, and they're fully developed galaxies with metals, with carbon-based compounds, and these compounds should not exist in that time frame. They should have never developed at that point. So once again, another data point, another nail in the coffin of the Big Bang theory, but just, you know, they are holding on to toothpicks, you know, just like the Dirty Snowball Comet model. We've finally, the European Space Agency landed on the surface of a comet. There's no water there, boys and girls. There's no ice. There's no snow. There's organic compounds. It's hot. It's a dry rock. There's nothing coming off the nucleus. There's no water detected within 10 kilometers of the nucleus. There's a lot of water in the tail, but where's that coming from? It's the plasma discharge comet model. It's my comet model. It explains this. But nope, they stick with that Dirty Snowball Comet model. They got to, because the funding, the textbooks, the notoriety, the, you know, putting down other people who have criticized them, the, you know, peer-reviewed journals, the publication, the money, the grants, everything, everybody's position, their snobbery, and, you know, these people are out of it. They're people that have no conscience, clearly, to just up and say, hey, we don't know anymore. One guy did. The head of the European Space Agency Rosetta mission effort was a physicist, and he was at the Paris Air Show a number of years ago after the Philae lander landed on the nucleus of Comet 67P. He hung his head, and he literally said that he had published many papers throughout his career using the ice ball comet model, the Dirty Snowball Comet model. And he said it's not correct, and he didn't know. These people are so out of it. You know, that's all I can say. Once again, we got some moon rocks to sell you. We got a Brooklyn Bridge to sell you. You know, we got some UFO information to sell you. Like I say, if you're going to make fake news, at least do a decent job of it. This year, here's another story. This year, according to industry experts, the world governments and primarily governments will spend $1 trillion on solar panels. But what's the problem? Well, the problem is they're only going to last 10 years. Their efficiency will in 10 years be 50% of what it is when they first install it. And this is to stop global warming. There's nothing worse at warming up the atmosphere than solar panels. First of all, you have to manufacture them. There's a lot of heat involved in that, the metal, the fabrication of the solar panels themselves, the shipping, the installation. But the worst part is they are about less than 20% efficient on a hot summer day when they're absorbing solar energy. 80% of the energy from the sun goes back directly into the atmosphere. So what you're doing is, let's take a scenario where you don't have solar panels, but you have trees, a forest. That would be the original configuration of planet Earth, is forest or grasslands or something. Well, what's going on? That sunlight, the vast majority of it, a very high percentage of it, is being absorbed by the plant material and being converted into carbon-based life forms, basically trees, plants, etc. And then when those plants die, the carbon material is sequestered and stays there. And so it's a way of keeping a balance with Earth's atmosphere. But the other issue is that it absorbs the sunlight. A solar panel does not. It absorbs maybe 20% of it, but the rest of that solar energy is converted into heat. These panels get extremely hot. When birds fly above them, it kills them. But the world is going to put $1 trillion into this so that the politicians can look green. This green movement is really a disaster ecologically. And the people that are doing this have no clue. All they know is they're running around with their little banner thinking they're saving the world, and they're not. They're destroying the world. I talked about this also on my show, that removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere is a very, very bad idea. If what they want to do is get back to the 1880s level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and the 1880 levels of oxygen in the atmosphere. But they really don't care so much about returning the oxygen. They just want to get rid of the carbon dioxide. So they find all kinds of ways to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. I was in a program that was called the Musk XPRIZE, and I quit. I just stopped participating in that because I realized, number one, yes, you can remove vast amounts of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. My particular plan would have returned oxygen into the atmosphere, which would be good. However, here's the issue. The Earth has been covered by cement. And that's the cause of the global heating. It's not the CO2 issue. If you start removing CO2 now, what's going to happen is we actually need more CO2 because to make the plants grow better. It's not an issue of the greenhouse effect. And if we have more plants, if we could re-green the planet Earth, then it would be the heat from the sun would be absorbed and we'd start dropping temperature. But when you put cement there, airports, cities, cut everything down, third world countries cutting everything down, that's what happened to India. Now they're having record heat. That's because the sunlight is being absorbed in the ground instead of being absorbed in plants where it would keep it cool. If you walk into a forest on a hot day, it automatically becomes cooler at the surface because those trees are absorbing the energy from the sun. That's not happening anymore. So anyway, $1 trillion going into solar panels this year, and by the time the solar panels start to fade and not be useful anymore, not providing the electricity, and by the way, the sun only shines, you know, most places in the world an average of 6 to 8 hours a day. And the panels don't move. These are stationary panels. And so they really do not produce that much electricity. it's really pretty bad. So most of these solar installations, it's simply wasted money. It's simply political posturing. Okay, just quickly, there's a comet 12P Brooks Pons that has developed an anti-tail once again, proving that, of course, they use this fairy tale argument that it's an optical illusion. They continue to use the dirty snowball comet model explanation that was developed in the 1950s when comet Aaron Rowland came into the solar system for the first time, showing to modern astronomers the sunward spike, very intense sunward spike. But here we have a comet these days that's visible with small telescopes where you can see the anti-tail. I believe it's only visible from the southern hemisphere at this point. So in summary, right now, the way the world is today, you should not remove carbon dioxide. We actually need more carbon dioxide. If you remove carbon dioxide, it's only 0.04% of the atmosphere. It's hardly any carbon dioxide in the atmosphere today at all. And so doubling or tripling it really would not have that big an effect. The whole idea of global climate change due to greenhouse gases is a myth. The real source of heating, yeah, things are heating up because there's cement all over the place. You're converting growth, plant growth, into cement cities. And the glaciers have gone away. When I was a kid, there were big glaciers in Montana, etc. And no more. They're all gone. So the Earth is heating up due to direct heating from the sun and direct heating from burning inert materials such as uranium in the nuclear reactors or carbon-based coal, natural gas, oil, etc. These are inert materials that we're burning, and that heat goes directly into the atmosphere. That is the cause of direct heating. Okay, just a quick, I'm going to jump right into Saturn's rings because I want to spend a good deal of time on it. Okay, so Saturn's rings, what's going on? Let me first start out by giving you the traditional explanation. And it's one of those Celsus of Moon Rocks stories, literally. The original explanation was that they believed that the solar system formed all at one time, 4.5 billion years ago. So how do you explain the rings of Saturn? This, by the way, is before they knew that Jupiter had rings, the sun has rings. It's called the zodiacal light. It's a ring of iron and heavy metals that orbit the sun in a plane, in a ring, just like Saturn's rings. And you can see it on certain days of the year when we come in line with the zodiacal disk. You can see the disk sticking up around over the horizon before sunrise and after sunrise. After sunset and before sunrise, you can see it sticking up off the horizon. And so anyway, that's the ring around the sun. Uranus and Neptune both have rings, but Saturn has this big ring system. So what makes it so special? Well, what they claimed was this was a broken up moon or something that fell into this flat plane. It's like a mile thick. It's like really thin. Saturn also spins very fast, so it has a bulge at its equator. And what that does is it pulls any material that's orbiting it into the plane of its rotation, the equatorial plane of Saturn's rotation. But when the Voyager spacecraft got there and took a close look, they saw that the rings were spiraling in like a record disc. You know, the old-fashioned record disc, you'd put the needle out at the outside of the record and the turntable would spin and the needle would, you know, pick up the vibrations off of the disc and translate that. It was then picked up in a little electronic device, which then was amplified and turned it into music. So you'd listen to music. But it spiraled in, And that's the same thing, that same effect with Saturn's rings. So the rings, literally, from the time the Voyager spacecraft got there and potentially the Pioneer, they knew that the rings were not long-term because they were spiraling into the upper atmosphere of Saturn. And, of course, that took a long time, but not a long time astronomically. In the astronomical sense, they're very short-lived, so they had to be replenished. So were they going to be replenished? What's replenishing them? Well, it's kind of like a snowstorm in a sense, because back to the standard explanation, that these are little chunks of a moon that didn't form or whatever, that formed and crashed with something and broke up into a million little pieces. That explanation simply isn't true. Now, just a side story, when I was at Cornell, I was in the math department at the time. I wrote a paper called Saturn Sweeper Moons Predicted. And it's actually peer-reviewed, published. It's published in a journal at the time called The Moon and the Planets. That title has since changed to The Moon. I think they shortened it. But the at the time, it was called The Moon and the Planets. It was a peer-reviewed journal out of Denmark, actually. And it was Hans Bethe who directed me there because my papers were not being published in the U.S. peer-reviewed journals. But anyway, I predicted that Saturn would have rings, or would have moons within its rings that swept it out. And these moons would be electrical, and using the plasma discharge comet model, because Saturn had a fusion-based reaction and a proton wind. So it developed a capacitor just like the sun does. So all of this was in this article. I first sent it to the Cornell Space Science Journal called CURRIS. And that was edited literally by Carl Sagan. But Carl, at the time, was off becoming a movie star in Los Angeles and making the Cosmos series. So anyway, his sit-in was a guy named Joe Burns. So I get a letter back from Joe. I submit the article to Icarus. And I thought, well, this would be apropos because all of the NASA scientists are literally resident at Cornell, you know, aside from JPL and Goddard and some in Los Alamos, but mainly a big bunch of them were at Cornell. And so I thought that would be an appropriate place to submit this article for publication. I get the letter back from Joe Burns saying, no, your explanation can't be correct because it is well known that the moons or the rings of Saturn are a remnant from 4.5 billion years ago from the formation of the solar system, and so your explanation cannot be correct. I then took the article and I sent it to the Moon and the Planets per recommendation of Hans Bethe, and got it published. But anyway, in the meantime, Joe Burns takes my paper, title everything, including sweeper moons, and becomes the NASA expert resident at Cornell about sweeper moons when he denied it to me. I still have all this paperwork. Anyway, that was the accepted story at the time, that all this debris was circling Saturn and was in this narrow band and was there since the formation of the solar system. Okay. Well, clearly it couldn't be correct because, like I say, as soon as those first spacecraft arrived at Saturn, they realized that the rings were spiraling inwards, and so therefore they had to be short-lived. But the explanation continued. As with any good bad theory, they can't dump the garbage out the back door and replace it with something else. So they're still talking about that, even though, you know, that's absurd. But the end result was that I understood the process going on with Saturn's rings. Well, first of all, what are they made of? Saturn's rings are made primarily of ice, but it's not pure ice. And it's kind of like a snowflake. If you understand how snowflakes form, they form in a cloud, But there's always a seed. If you could dissect a snowflake, or put it under a microscope and look at a snowflake, you would find that it has a small dust particle in the center. So you need a couple things for snowflakes to form. You need an electric field. You need water, of course. That's the ice crystals building up. And you need this seed piece of dust, very microscopic size piece of dust, and then literally it's a comet type of process, and they can reproduce snowflakes in a laboratory now, but they need that electric field. So where does that come from? Well, that's the electric field is part of the vertical electric field of Earth, which is part of the overall electric field of the solar system. Okay. So at any rate, the rings at Saturn, the material in the rings is very similar. So they're ice crystals that form, but they don't have enough electric field to actually form snowflakes. There's probably, if you look closely, you would find snowflakes in the rings of Saturn. But then again, since it's a vacuum environment of outer space, maybe the snowflakes don't form. We don't really know. Nobody's ever tried that. The snowflakes that have been made in a laboratory are in a chamber with an atmosphere that has water, it has fine particles, and a lot of times they'll use a pinhead, and the actual snowflake is forming on the head of a pin that has a voltage. They tried making snowflakes for years. I talk about this in, is it my Atlantis? No, which book is it? I think it's the Calculate Primes book where I actually talk about making snowflakes as a similar process to the development of prime numbers, building larger structures from small structures. But at any rate, in the laboratory, they tried and tried to make crystals, and they'd have a pin sticking in there thinking that the snowflake would form on the end of the crystal. And then somehow, either by accident or by somebody thinking of it, they put an electric field onto the pinhead and immediately started forming snowflakes. So you need an electric field, and not only an electric field, but a non-uniform electric field, which is very different from your average run-of-the-block electric field that exists in nature. Okay, so now getting down to the core of the question that one of the listeners sent in was, where does this material come from, or is there a starter material for the rings? And the answer is yes, that water is, first of all, you have dust, which there's a lot of in outer space. But once the material starts orbiting Saturn and it starts working its way in, the situation is the bulge in Saturn, because it spins so fast, it like bulges out, causes anything above that ring plane to pull down and anything below the ring plane to pull up. So eventually everything works into this very thin plane by fairly strong gravitational forces due to Saturn's atmosphere. And Saturn has a proton wind. Well, what is proton? You put a hydrogen, or you put an electron there, excuse me, and you get hydrogen. So that's the hydrogen. The other thing you need is oxygen to form water, and then in the cold environment of outer space, you have ice. Pluto has ice on it, water ice. It has primarily nitrogen, hydrogen compounds frozen, the composition of Pluto, but there's a lot of water out in that part of the solar system. We see comets form out there. Very large comets. So there's a lot of water in the vicinity of Saturn. And so as Saturn's gravitational field starts to control this water, it comes into that region of Saturn, and it starts basically solidifying into little ice particles, probably mostly a few inches across. Very small ice particles that are in the rings. And then the sweeper moons, what I predicted, was that because of a very characteristic thing that had been observed from the very beginning, hundreds of years ago, when they first started observing Saturn with telescopes, is the inside of the rings, there were many ring packages, so to speak, and they were lettered, they were they were categorized by letters A, B, C, D, F, out to F. And but they had a very characteristic fading on the inner edge of the ring, whereas they were very sharp on the outer edge of the ring. And that would be exactly what would happen if you had a sweeper moon in there that was working like the plasma discharge comet model. What is a comet is short on the nose side, on the sunward side, and its tail is long on the other side. So that would, and also there was one of the rings which had a characteristic fading, which was just in one area. So this moon was not going around the entire circle in the rings. It was just cutting through in a certain place. And so I said that ring, that moon, sweeper moon, would be out of the plane of the planets. They discovered all these. And I should have gotten credit for it, but of course, NASA doesn't want to talk to me. They don't like me because, I don't know. I don't know what the story is. Anyway, you just write, chalk that up to history. But all of this will come out. All of this is public information. The Joe Burns thing, you know. All of these people will get their comeuppance, as you know, you use in the Smoky Mountains, an old-time term. That people will get theirs eventually. It always works out in the end. But the bottom line is that the Saturn rings are temporary. They're restocked continuously. There's water coming in continuously to resupply them. The material is pulled into the ring plane. And when material comes through, it's not only gravitational, but there are electrical effects also that enhance the accumulation of water onto these ring particles that are frozen. And as with any frozen process, you know, they just build up with time, but they don't have time to get too big because they're spiraling inwards and eventually falling into the atmosphere of Saturn. So that's the short version. That's the amount of time I have to do cover this topic on this show. But it would be fun. I could do a whole university graduate level course on just Saturn's rings alone and how it relates to the solar system, the overall electric field of the solar system, etc. And I'm just about out of time. So I just want to remind you the MR5 whole house water filter, best deal. There's still a sale on. It's $100 off the already reduced price. So it's $16.50 for the best deal. That's the MR5 whole house water filter plus this UV sterilizer. I have all my books, etc., discs, CDs, DVDs, all downloadable now on my webpage, the webpage jmccsci.com, 7 letters. And I've got a big, big announcement coming up in the next few days. So stay tuned. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.